06-5230. Michelle Waite, Green, this action on behalf of the United States of America, appellate, United States of America versus American National Red Cross. Mr. McKnight for the appellate, Ms. Hilmer for Appley USA, and Mr. Bowen for Appley American National Red Cross.
Good morning, Your Honors.
All right, go ahead.
May it please the Court. Your Honor, this case arises out of a situation where in December of 2003, the American Red Cross discovered that one of its phlebotomists, that's a blood collecting specialist, apparently collected over 500 units of blood using an improper procedure that by the manufacturer's own instructions and by the standard operating procedures of the American Red Cross that rendered the blood contaminated and had to be used within 24 hours. Contrary to the manufacturer's instructions, the blood was actually released to the public beginning on December 19th and 24th, that is longer than 24 hours after it was even discovered, and presumably the 500 units weren't all collected on December 18th when the problem was discovered. The Red Cross at the time was operating under a consent decree which had it monitored by Judge Penn and then in existence the second consent decree for a number of years. We brought a case on behalf of the United States government, that's Ms. Michelle Hoyt, who is a senior auditor at the Red Cross who discovered this during the course of her audit of the Penn Jersey. We brought this matter under the False Claims Act. As the Court is aware, we allege that there was a A7 violation, that is, that an obligation was established and created by the obligation under the consent decree. And our contention is that under the consent decree, the Red Cross was aware that.
So you're focusing on your retaliation claim now?
Pardon me?
You're focusing on your retaliation claim now?
No, Your Honor. No. I'm focusing on both. I was just giving the Court some background about the case.
Well, which of your two claims do you want to talk about here?
Well, let's talk about first about the fact that the under SWIFT, Your Honor, the trial court dismissed the case based upon its interpretation of this Court's decision in SWIFT, which used the term unfettered, giving the government, interpreted by the Court anyway, as a unrestricted right to dismiss a False Claims Act matter. We recognize that SWIFT uses the term unfettered. We recognize the government has broad discretion in this area, but we submit that under SWIFT, the door was left open for other circumstances where the Court would play a larger role and determining whether it was an appropriate matter for prosecutorial exercise.
I agree that the door was left open as to fraud. The
right.
question is whether it's any further open.
Well, Your Honor, I understand that the Court used the word fraud, but the Court went further. It said whether fraud or any other exception would be allowed by this Court, I believe,
but
is the language.
Haven't we got to read that language or any other in light of the first part of the sentence? While the government conceded, etc., no evidence of that sort, fraud on the court sort of evidence, was presented, and therefore we do not pass on whether this type of exception or any other. And I agree that the language or any other is obscure, but in context, I don't see how it can be taken as referring to anything more than something closely to do with fraud.
Well, Your Honor, there's another part of the decision at page 253 where the Court talks about the Constitution entrusts the executive with the duty to take care It goes on to say, the decision is whether to bring an action on behalf of the United States is therefore a decision generally committed to the government's absolute discretion. That's at page 253.
Yeah.
And then at the next sentence, the SWIFT panel acknowledges that this discretion may not be absolute.
Yeah.
And there's no reference to fraud or anything. It's just a suggestion that the power of the prosecutor under these circumstances comes from Article 2, Section 3 of the Constitution. So it's our position, Your Honor, that if the prosecutor's power under Article 2, Section 3 is limited in some respect, and it's a narrow limitation.
The door being kept open for fraud.
That's consistent.
Whether it's consistent with anything more.
It's consistent with the door being open at any time that there's a manifest public interest at risk, Your Honor. Meaning that if the question that we pose, and we recognize that it's not an easy thing to do, is that should a prosecutor in a criminal context have a broader discretion in dismissal than the government's prosecutorial discretion in the context of a False Claims Act matter where Congress specifically created a shared responsibility. And, Your Honor, it's our position that the government's authority in that regard should not be broader. And so the Cowan standard that we've suggested to the court really is quite conservative, and it would only come into play in very limited circumstances. If the court adopts an approach where on a case-by-case basis it will first look at fraud and then look at each other circumstances as it arises in order to determine whether this too is going to be an exception to this rule, then you will see.
Well, wouldn't that be giving us, quote, general oversight over the executive's judgment as to which cases to dismiss? That's a quote from Swift.
The question of general oversight, Your Honor, mm-hmm. is that if you look at the Sequoia decision and the way the Sequoia decision defines the court's role, I think that the Cowan decision and the way it's defined that in the first instance the government has an absolute discretion and then you look for a manifest public interest as a guiding point, that will limit the number of cases where this authority is exercised, as opposed to requiring the court on a case-by-case basis to first say, now we're dealing with fraud, now we're dealing with some other egregious set of circumstances. If the court looks at fraud as the only exception, then the court will be deciding each exception as it comes up one at a time. And we're suggesting that if the other standard under Cowan has been a workable and usable standard by all the circuits of the United States just about in addressing prosecutorial discretion without unduly restricting the prosecutor's power in a criminal context, that the same standard would be useful and applicable under these contexts with no less of an intrusion into the prosecutorial role, Your Honor. With respect to our second issue, and that's the issue of whether Ms. Hoyt raised a viable Section H claim as it's defined under Yesidian. It's our contention that the trial court below interpreted the word viable as meaning winning. And in the context of Yesidian, as the court will recall, Yesidian actually lost his underlying False Claims Act claim at the time that the issue of whether his Section H claim was even being considered by the D.C. Circuit. So had winning the underlying claim been the benchmark, and the Yesidian court did address this issue, then there would be no reason for it to have considered the Section H matter. It's our contention, Your Honor, that the Section H protection, as interpreted by Yesidian, is broader than that.
Suppose that an employee blows the whistle on something that is something bad, but transparently beyond the False Claims Act. How do you treat that case?
Well, the Yesidian court actually talks about potential fraud, and also talks about facts that a claimant is looking at before all the facts have been put together. So I think
there's widespread agreement that the whistleblower, the claimant in discrimination cases, is given a fairly wide berth, at least as long as it's not frivolous or in bad faith. But on a legal issue, where you're talking about radically expanding the area in which employers are free to dismiss employees, one might think it to be different.
Well, the question is whether this is a radical expansion or not. We're looking at whether there was a potential fraud, and that turns on the issue of...
Well, not exactly.
Well,
I mean, we're looking at the statutory language, that is to say, whether it's really two bits of statutory language. First, H, whether the acts are in furtherance of an action under this section, and then we have to turn to A7, conceal, avoid, decrease an obligation to pay or transmit money or property. So we have to put those two together.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And what I'm saying to the court is that under the facts as presented in this particular case, that Ms. Hoyt was investigating potential fraud under the statute. She may not have been successful at the end of the day. But the fact of the matter is that there was a consent decree in place, that if the Red Cross were successful in hiding this information from the government, then they would avoid almost certain potential fines that had been
issued. This is true for any activity by an employer that is subject to government penalty.
No, Your Honor, not in the same sense, because most of the activities of the government or a government employee or an agency are not covered by a consent decree. So there are...
I'm not just sure how the consent decree really changes matters. It may sort of accelerate or simplify some steps. It seems to me the basic steps of enforcing a fine or penalty are right there.
But more so than just expediting, it actually changes, Your Honor, the standard that's applied to determining.
There's still a standard that must be met.
There's a standard that must be met, but it's far different, Your Honor, from the cases in which there's a regulatory violation, where the court simply said, and looking at whether an obligation existed, because you have a scenario where someone got the equivalent of a traffic ticket and that had yet to be adjudicated, that wasn't sufficient enough to create an obligation. Here we have a consent decree where many of the regulatory steps were removed and things that would not ordinarily trigger fines. For example...
Well, except the consent decree, the FDA has to jump through, first of all, it says may, right? It says the FDA may assess a penalty.
It does, and that leaves it up to the discretion of the consent decree.
And then it says, in considering whether to do this, it has to consider these three factors: the potential effect of the event on the public health, e.g. number of exposures to, you know, it goes on, it's got three of these. So even if you're right that the district court's standard is too rigid, tell me how you can interpret this in any way as, quote, an obligation.
Well, Your Honor, there would be other basis for an obligation here. For example, if you look to see whether an adverse determination has occurred, then there are certain steps that may trigger a certain procedural protections that the Red Cross might take advantage of. But there are actual reporting obligations that the Red Cross has that are fairly strict and do not exist in the regulatory world. And so as soon as they observe a problem where unsuitable blood may have been released into the public, they have three different reporting obligations that are triggered within 48.
But before the FDA can impose a fine, doesn't it have to make findings on these three factors?
They would have to make a conclusion that such occurred, Your Honor.
Right.
And then once they make that conclusion that such occurred,
says FDA must consider the following factors. Doesn't it have to do that for whatever basis there is for a potential fine?
It would have to do that, but in a regular situation, Your Honor, it would have to go through a court procedure, injunctive
process. Well, the
court
still has to approve this, doesn't it?
The court has to approve it, but on a completely different standard, an arbitrary and capricious standard, and they've given up many of their rights to challenge the fine. That's an entirely different situation than what the Red Cross would face if they were simply facing a regulatory process where the FDA decided that they might have done something wrong. So the consent decree does have effect. It does limit their rights. It does limit their opportunities to fight not just the liability question, but the question of the amount of the fines. And so also the other point, Your Honor, is that obligation in this circuit has not been defined. And so at the time that she did bring this action and claim that she was the victim of this, that the potential that she faced at that time, meaning that she brought it to attention, she believes it's a violation of the consent decree. So it was a potential matter under this case. There are courts that have decided that obligation would reach such conduct, Your Honor. And so
What's your best case on that?
Our best case on that would be the, I think it's a Tenth Circuit case, Your Honor.
Is that PEMCO?
No, Your Honor. The I'm forgetting the pronunciation of it because of the moment.
I had thought your strongest case was PEMCO, and it didn't seem to me anywhere near this.
I think that the strongest case, I believe, was the Conagra case out west, Your Honor, where the court ruled that an obligation didn't have to be fixed in all respects before it could be construed as being an obligation. And that's the case which I think is strong because of the fact that this particular matter, sure, it's not fixed in all regards, but the likelihood, given the surrounding facts, that they would be faced with penalties and the likelihood that the penalties would stick are very strong as the structure of the consent decree is in place, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve whatever time I have for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Hillman.
Good morning, Your Honors. Tracy Helmer for the United States. Your Honors, the False Claims Act specifically permits the government to dismiss a case notwithstanding the relator's objection once notice and an opportunity for a hearing have been afforded. This court held in Swift that provision means exactly what it says. The district court followed that provision to the letter and followed this court's decision in Swift. Accordingly, in accordance with the statute, as it's set up, as it's plainly interpreted and correctly interpreted, we submit in Swift, the government did obtain dismissal of the QUETAM action here. Mr. McKnight argues for a much broader review than any court has found appropriate. In Sequoia Orange and Reidenauer, the two other cases, the other circuit court cases, a rational basis test was applied. We submit that the motion filed below would have passed muster even under that test. Although not required to do so by the binding precedent of Swift, we did inform the district court that there was a consent decree that was being actively enforced and monitored by both the FDA and the Department of Justice, and that it was present before the district court, another judge of the district court. We further advised the court that even in cases where the government does decline, as we did here, there are additional resources expended in monitoring the case, perhaps in discovery. And those considerations were found by Swift to also justify the government's decision to dismiss. We do not agree that a review as searching as a public interest review under the criminal rules of procedure should apply here, and that's inconsistent with the statute as well as with this court's decision. If the court has questions about the Swift matter, no, I'm happy to address them. Otherwise, I'd like to go on to the...
Why don't we talk about obligation?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'll just tell you what my question is. I think I probably agree with you that the district court's standard is far too rigid. But I can't tell from your brief what you think the standard should be. And in particular, you say in your brief that that liability can't be defeated just because the government has discretion, right?
That's right.
And just because there may be procedures the government has to go through to collect the obligation. You say both of those.
Yes, Your Honor.
So why isn't that this case?
Well,
the government has discretion. It says may. And there are procedures it has to go through to collect, to impose the fine.
Your Honor, our position is that for a False Claims Act matter to be cognizable under A7, it has to fall into one of two categories. It could be a fixed obligation, as in the case of a judgment or a contract
okay,
that specifically provides.
Right. That's the easy case.
That's an easy case.
Okay. Talk about the hard case.
The alternative yeah. is that it could arise under a relationship that the government has, typically a more commercial type of relationship where there is a contractual obligation or a grantor-grantee relationship, a licensor-licensee relationship, or a fee-based relationship. For example, in the Barani case, which Mr. McKnight referred to, that's the Tenth Circuit decision, there the court held specifically that the fact that the government had some discretion whether or not to insist upon new applications did not defeat the possibility of an actionable A7 claim. That was a fee-based relationship where the government, in fact, is expecting, in general, to get paid. So that if there is a license or a certification required and there's a fee associated with that, and someone attempts to avoid having to pay that through means that are false or fraudulent, that would be a cognizable action, and
well,
that's
so why is it the consent decree create that relationship?
The consent decree is of another sort. We think the consent
well, yes,
decree
it's different from a contract. Well, actually, it's not different from a contract, is it?
It has features of a contract, right. And it has features of a judgment.
Right.
The consent decree in this case, however, we think is much closer in nature to the situation in the Bain case that was before the Fifth Circuit. There were releases, alleged releases of substances, and then allegedly false statements made to deceive the government so that the government would not impose penalties for those releases. We think this is similar to that, in that what you're talking about is really unassessed potential penalties. The government is not expecting Red Cross to have to pay fines under the consent decree. We hope it doesn't. So it's not a situation, for example, where the government provides a loan and expects to get paid back.
Okay, so this is why you, if the count one had not been dismissed, if we were hearing an appeal of a judgment on that, then I can understand your argument here that this is not a False Claims Act case. But we're talking about count two, the retaliation part of it now. And why isn't it enough that that the relator here was pursuing what she thought was an action under this section?
Your Honor.
In other words, it's designed to protect people who bring these actions, and even if they might ultimately lose, they're in the meantime protected from retaliation.
Your Honor, the government doesn't take a position on that particular question. The position that we take with
okay.
respect to
That's
A7.
Fair. I understand. Okay. Gotcha. Right.
If the court has yeah. further questions, I'm happy
right.
to address them.
I understand your point.
Thank you. Do you have any questions?
No.
Thank you.
Mr. Fetter?
May it please the court, my name is John Fletter. I'm counsel for the American National Red Cross. Accompanying me today is Christian Hansen, who is senior counsel with the Red Cross. Let me first say that in response to Mr. McKnight's point, I don't believe that the district court applied the standard that he claims the district court applied in terms of the standard for what is an obligation. Judge Friedman didn't say that Ms. Hoyt had to have a winning case, nor did we argue that Ms. Hoyt had to have a winning case. What we argued below, what we've argued in this court, and what Judge Friedman found is that there was no set of facts that she could have possibly alleged that would have given her a winning case. So it's not as if
no Judge set of facts she could have alleged within the framework of what she was pursuing.
That's correct, Judge Williams. That because of the requirement that she have shown that there was an obligation, and because of the structure of the consent decree, and the fact is we also say that she had no right to enforce the consent decree, but putting that aside, just the wording of the consent decree, which, as Judge Tatel has said, was discretionary, there is no way that she could have possibly prevailed in her False Claims Act case. And that's
why is that? I mean, why? I mean, the government could have decided to proceed with fines and made the judgments here and prevailed in the district court.
Judge Tatel, the government could have decided to proceed with fines, but under this record, the government hasn't decided to proceed with fines.
Well, I thought your argument was that if the government did that, it wouldn't make it fall within A7. Which is a completely separate issue.
That is in fact our position, yes, that if the government had imposed the fines, which they didn't, and if the Red Cross had lost the appeal to the court, which of course never happened here because there was no appeal, then we still say it would not be actionable, but that's not the facts we have here. We have a situation where, acting pursuant to the consent decree, the FDA didn't impose any fines on the American Red Cross.
But we've held, haven't we, that you're protected by this provision, even if your False Claims Act case loses.
And I think there's a distinction between this case and the reservation that has been left by this court in two separate respects. Sure, if it so happens that a plaintiff alleges some facts and cannot prove them at trial, then he or she may have a basis for a retaliation claim. Here, we're talking straight a question of law. And as a matter of law, there was no obligation. There never could have been any obligation because the American Red Cross was not fined here. But on top of that, I think it's worth looking at the Yasudian language, where the court talked about what is required in order for somebody to have an H action. And the court very clearly said in several places that mere regulatory violations do not qualify. And no matter how Ms. Hoyt wants to dress up the allegations here, what she is really talking about are mere regulatory violations.
But Yasudian also says, nor was it necessary for plaintiff to know that the investigation she was pursuing could lead to an FCA suit.
And we are not disputing that. I know, but
right, that's what Yasudian says.
But Yasudian says.
But why isn't that this case? Sure, she might not get it. She might not ultimately win because it might be viewed ultimately by the court as simply a regulatory matter.
But if she believed
she was pursuing a False Claims Act case, why isn't that enough? As long as that was reasonable.
There's no suggestion in the cases nor in the statute for what she believed, Your Honor, being relevant in this context where there was no possibility that she could recover regardless of what she believed because the statute, the consent decree talks in terms of may, not the FDA being required to impose a penalty, and it is for that reason that there was no penalty imposed here. And those are the set of facts that we have here. It may be that she thought a penalty should have been imposed, but because it wasn't her decision to make, there simply could not have possibly been an obligation. Now, there may be a different situation if we had a...
You're somewhat at odds with the government in that argument, aren't you? Because the government's stress is not the discretion of the government official, the enforcing official, but the difference between essentially some sort of a commercial or quasi-commercial relationship and a regulatory enforcement context. No, we do not disagree with him on that. We agree that there may be situations where you're not in a regulatory context, where there could possibly be a contract where there could that could possibly be enforceable. But in this situation where you're dealing with regulatory violations and potential penalties, the law is just crystal clear. And the case that Mr. McKnight says is his chief case, Barani says very clearly, the discretion vested in prosecutors and other government officials to determine whether to seek fines or penalties renders the alleged, quote, obligation, end of quote, contingent, and thus beyond the reach of the statute. And that's exactly what we have here. We have the possible imposition of penalties, but no penalties having actually been imposed.
But if the purpose, I'll ask you the same question that I asked government, if the purpose of the statute is to protect people from retaliation who are engaged in activities, quote, in furtherance of an action under this statute, you may have given very powerful reasons why you would prevail in count one, but isn't the purpose of this section to protect people from retaliation for simply bringing these cases?
Well,
and wouldn't it defeat the protection of it if, we were to impose a rule that said, you basically had to have a pretty good case before you were protected from retaliation?
Your Honor, I don't think this would be a new imposition of a rule. Uh-huh. I mean, this court three times has said that in order to have an H claim, you have to present a complaint that, quote, reasonably could lead to a viable False Claims Act case, and this is the same standard that has been applied in five or six other circuits.
Well, other circuits have also applied a different standard, right? They've also, the Seventh, Eighth, and Ninth Circuits have a completely different test. They ask whether the employee in good faith believed it could lead to it, and whether a reasonable person thought that, and whether that was a reasonable position for the person. Correct?
I'm not sure. I focus more on the D.C. Circuit here and the language that's been repeatedly used.
I just only raise it because you cited other circuits.
Well, also, I think the Sukkot case is pretty clear. It's not a long decision by this court, but mm-hmm. what happened in Sukkot is the court ruled that the H claim had to be dismissed because there was no unlawful kickback. The court didn't get into an analysis of what the relator believed or didn't believe were the facts of this case, and we submit that that's exactly what the law is and should be in a case such as this, where it is clear-cut that as a matter of law, regardless of any evidentiary review, that the law is clear that there is no obligation and
so
there can't be an obligation.
If a person is pursuing a False Claims Act case and doesn't know that that case is barred by the statute of limitations, can that person be fired?
Your Honor, I think there are two questions there. One is whether the person can be fired versus whether there's an action under the False Claims Act. I don't want to comment on what rights somebody might have
I'm not just asking whether a person who is pursuing a claim without knowing it's barred by the statute of limitations is protected by this provision or not.
There may be some factual issues involved in a statute of limitations.
Those are the only facts you know. That's it.
I am not
That's
certain.
It. You're not certain.
What I am certain.
Suppose the person bringing the case is the second person to have engaged in this investigation, not the first.
And there can only be one original source.
Right. Not protected by this section.
It might well not be protected, but I think that the dispositive point here is there's a distinction between whether a relator like Ms. Poit has protection under the False Claims Act versus whether she may or may not have any protection under any other federal statute.
We're only asking about the retaliation provision.
Understood.
I'm trying to test your theory here that the person has to bring a legally viable claim. And I've just given you two examples of a person who's not bringing a legally viable claim, but it just seems to me a little odd to say that that person would not nevertheless be protected by the anti-retaliation provisions.
Judge Tatel, whether it seems odd, I think it's required by the discussion in the case law and by the statute. And again, we're not passing on whether Ms. Hoyt may or may not have any other rights under federal or D.C. law. We're not saying she does. We're not saying she doesn't. We're simply saying that there are requirements that are imposed before she can go forward with an H claim under the False Claims Act, and as a matter of law, she couldn't qualify.
All right, thank you. Does Mr. McKnight have any time? Why don't you take 2 minutes, Mr. McKnight?
Your Honor, the Yucidian Court actually said at page 740 that they examined whether Yucidian had a good faith basis for going forward at the time of the retaliation. So I think that was an important consideration. And they looked at the issue about whether you had to be a winner, whether you had to have a viable claim or not. And they cited to a Clean Water Act case, I believe I cited it in my papers, about the fact that you don't have to have a winning and completed claim at that particular moment. So they did refer to notions of good faith.
Can we take an analogous issue in employment well, this is employment discrimination of a kind, but I was thinking of the more conventional employment discrimination cases. Suppose a gay person believes he's being discriminated against on that ground and starts to complain to superiors in his office and is then fired. And I'm talking about the federal system. And suppose if homosexuality were a forbidden ground of discrimination, he'd have a great claim. Is he protected from dismissal?
Under federal law, Title VII.
Yeah.
I would say he probably doesn't have grounds for dismissal, but that's distinguishable.
Grounds for retaliation.
For a retaliation claim under that particular statute. Here the issue is whether he is investigating potential fraud at the time.
Yeah, but you get out of the – he was investigating or he was pursuing a matter of potential discrimination.
No,
just
Your Honor.
It was just on a ground that wasn't covered by the federal statute.
Right, Your Honor, but I think under the False Claims Act, I think that Ms. Hoyt was investigating potential fraud at the time. And that's the language used by
Yucidian. You keep getting around the statutory language by substituting the phrase potential fraud.
That's a phrase used by the court in Yucidian.
Yucidian wasn't purporting to give an encyclopedic treatment of the matter, which would have been inappropriate.
They dropped the footnote and said an employee's non-frivolous complaint should not have to be guaranteed to withstand external review in order to merit protection under the...
This is absolutely standard for ordinary factual disputes and inadequacies.
But I think you have to be concerned with the chilling effect that moving in that direction would have.
The chilling effect works both ways, right? Because on a view as broad as your view, employers are chilled from exercising what, under the law, are really their rights.
No, Your Honor,
it seem to have been their rights.
If
the case comes out your way, then they aren't the employer's rights.
Well, Your Honor, I guess we disagree as to what the facts suggest. And here, I think that the facts of this case suggest a potential fraud being committed by the Red Cross under
Except
these circumstances.
Suppose that her claim, generously viewed, is no more promising than in my hypothetical about the gay employee.
There must be some point in time where the protection of the act doesn't reach the individual. It's our position that this is not that case, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right, thank you.